Good morning, brothers and sisters. If we read through the book of Amos, we'll realize that not very little is given about the life of Amos. Unlike David, unlike Esther, to a degree, and certainly unlike Peter, not much is revealed about the character of Amos explicitly. Nevertheless, the prophecy of Amos and his surroundings tell us much about what the character of Amos is like. So much of what we will say this morning will be by deduction, which we believe is fairly safe deduction. But nevertheless, it's not information which is explicitly revealed to us. And to that end, we will look at the book of Amos just by giving some background information. Very briefly, and I think in a way the best way of looking at the character of Amos is not just to see what is revealed about Amos, which is not extensive, but also by looking at the age in which he lived, by looking at the duties he had, by looking at the message he had to deliver, we will be able to see what kind of man Amos was. He was one of the earliest prophets. He came in the time 780 to 740 BC, so long before Judah were taken captive, not particularly long before Samaria were taken captive. Only Jonah is probably earlier than Amos. As a point of interest, Amos was actually sent to the 10 tribes. He delivered messages against more than just the 10 tribes. The first two chapters regard judgments prophesied against Israel, Judah, and several of the nations around them. But the burden of the book of Amos is directed against the 10 tribes of Samaria. But he was from Judah. So evidently we can see that things were particularly bad in Samaria, that Yahweh couldn't even furnish them with a prophet of the 10 tribes. Thus, Yahweh decided to use one of the prophets of Judah to conduct his message to the 10 tribes. Amos means burden or burden bearer. Now, no burden is pleasant, whichever way we want to look at it. Whether we're carrying something heavy, we'd rather be free of that burden. Or whether we look at the burden in a spiritual aspect, they aren't pleasant either. Whether it's a trial of some kind, whether it's a problem that we have for whatever reason, maybe of our own making sometimes. Burdens are never pleasant. And there is an unpleasant character to the book. It's an unpleasant character because the burden of Amos was essentially regarding the judgments that would come upon God's people. In fact, the entire book is burdensome. The entire book refers to judgment, except for the last five verses. Unfortunately, this is necessary. Just as necessary as was prophesied by the prophets, that when God's judgment is in the earth, only then will the inhabitants learn righteousness. I suppose we can rather take a similar view when perhaps someone has diagnosed a brother or sister with cancer. The news is catastrophic and causes great pain. But if it's never diagnosed, it can never be treated. If we are never aware of something being wrong with us, then there is no way that we can possibly hope to be healed of that malady. And that is just the same with the people of Israel. And it is there's no difference in the application on a personal, individual level. And if we, as we conduct our thoughts on the book and the character of Amos, we'll see that there's a similar picture between the times of Amos and the Brotherhood today. There was a time, Amos was sent in a time of apparent prosperity. And yet, even then, they were warnings of severe trouble. There appeared to be great success in the land of Israel and Judah. But as we see, Amos, not one from a prosperous background, and we will see that how much more powerful Yahweh's message is when the conduit for that message is a faithful, uncompromising character like Amos, unaffected by the wealth of this world, unaffected by what this world can offer, but totally focused and dedicated to the ways of Yahweh. And I think perhaps if there's one thing we can take from this morning, is that the characteristics of God's servants have a direct bearing on the power of the witnessing. Secular writers have referred to the fact that like in the early apostolic days, the truth was at its most powerful because the servants of Yahweh, the witnesses, held the future glory, the coming kingdom, as infinitely more important than anything this life can offer. But those same secular writers also note that as the centuries progressed, particularly in the declension leading up to the Constantinian era, the characteristics of the servants changed and the things of this world became more important. In direct relation to that, the power of the witnessing weakened. And that has been a repeat procedure. We have the same in the days leading up to the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, where the power of the witnessing weakened because of the involvement of the witnesses in the things of the world. This is what we see in the days of Amos, and it's worth remembering that in direct proportion, or perhaps in inverse proportion, as our understanding and our love of the truth is our bearing our interest in the world, so will the power of our witnessing be. There's a striking similarity between the people of God then and the people of God now. And I can't do better than to quote Brother Grocott to remind us of why we study these things. Our principal purpose in studying any portion of Scripture must be for lessons and guidance for ourselves. And as we consider the nation of Israel in the days of Amos, it's worth remembering that we should never distance ourselves from Israel. We can tend to say that was Israel, they were really bad, they were idolatrous, but the point of the matter is they were made of the same flesh as we are, they had the same battles just in a different epoch, and the warnings then are as applicable to us as they were to them. In fact, as we look through the book of Amos, we may even see some disturbing parallels. So the book of Amos then is divisible into three parts. The first part are regarding prophecies of the six surrounding nations and Judah, starting in chapter 1 verse 3 to chapter 2 verse 4. And it's interesting to note that the judgments on the nations are predominantly, if not entirely, due to their policies against Israel, with the exception of Moab. Second part of the book, which is the bulk of the book, are the judgments against the northern kingdom. And as we've said, the last few verses of the book regarding the glorious restoration of the 12 tribes under their Messiah. So as a background then, it seems that the 10 tribes particularly were in a time of upward prosperity. Jeroboam, if we look at the parallel record in the Kings, had restored and regained territories which were lost under Jehu. Having regained these territories, wealth was appropriated to the nation. Now here perhaps is the lesson, because wealth can be a blessing, but more often than not, it's a testing. Abraham was wealthy, David was wealthy. The point of the matter was, they never put any trust in the wealth. But they were unique. Because most people, when they are provided with wealth, start to lose the faith. And in actual fact, it would appear that the blessings here were misinterpreted by the people. They thought that the wealth that was given to them was because they were doing what was right, and that therefore they were being rewarded. But such material wealth from Yahweh does not necessarily mean he approves of our doings. In fact, if we refer again to the Constantinian era, the Bishop of Rome in the times leading up to Constantine was one of the wealthiest people in the empire. Does that therefore mean that he was blessed with Yahweh? Far from it. So, the people in the days of Amos had to understand, and it would appear that they never did come to understand, despite Amos's efforts, that the wealth that they had accrued was not to their commendation. Look at verse 1 of Amos chapter 1. The words of Amos, who was among the herdmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam the son of Joash king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. So right at the outset then, we have a chronology tied down to the days of Uzziah of Judah and Jeroboam of Israel, and 2 years before an earthquake. It must have been an immense catastrophe to the people of Israel for it to be used as such a reference point. Not just do we refer to this in Amos, but it is used as a parallel 250 years later in the days of Zechariah, when he refers to the earthquake in the days of Uzziah. Now bear in mind, Zechariah was after the Babylonian siege. Babylon had disappeared from the world political scene, never to resurface. In the days of the Persians then, we see the people of Israel being referred to this earthquake. So we understand then that the Babylonian siege and the terrors of what went with it, the captivity and the terrors of what went with that, and the time that was spent in Babylon, did not erase this terrible earthquake from the national memory. It must have been an immense event, one that brought destruction with it. And it set the tone for the prophecy. Because as is so often the case in an earthquake, fire was to accompany it. And that is interesting, because if we turn up a few verses in the prophecy, we will see that fire is an important theme. And nearly all the nations are judged with the prospect of fire, either typical or even literal. Chapter 1 verse 4 says, "But I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad." So Syria is to receive the fire of judgment. Likewise, Philistia in chapter 1 verse 7, "I will send a fire on the wall of Gaza, which shall devour the palaces thereof." Likewise, Tyre in verse 10, "I will send a fire on the wall of Tyrus, which shall devour the palaces thereof." Likewise, Edom in verse 11, "For 3 transgressions of Edom and 4 will not turn away the punishment thereof, because he did pursue his brother with the sword, and did cast off all pity, and his anger did take perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. But I will send a fire upon Timan, which shall devour the palaces of Bozrah." Likewise, Ammon, verse 14, "I will kindle a fire in the wall of Rabbah, and it shall devour the palaces thereof." Likewise, Moab, in chapter 2 and verse 2, "I will send a fire upon Moab." And lastly, Judah and Jerusalem, chapter 2 verse 5, "But I will send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem." And anyone who has seen any television or any other kind of footage or photography of an earthquake will see the fires go with it. The great fire of San Francisco, apparently, the fires caused as much problem as the astral destruction caused by the earthquake. So fire would suggest that what was seen during that earthquake should have been a reminder of the fire of judgment and destruction that would come upon these nations for their respective misdeeds. And there's even a recurring reference to earthquake if we turn to chapter 4 and verse 11. "I have overthrown some of you, as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah." That's probably a reference then to the earthquake which would literally overthrow various buildings and things. Chapter 8 and verse 8, "Shall not the land tremble for this, and everyone mourn that dwelleth therein? And it shall rise up wholly as a flood, and it shall be cast out and drowned as by the flood of Egypt." And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in the clear day, and I will turn your feasts into mourning, and all your songs into lamentation. And I will bring up sackcloth upon all loins, and baldness upon every head. And I will make it as the morning of an only sun, and the end thereof as a bitter day. Yes, these are rather more symbolic, typical descriptions of what was going to come as a result of the judgment. But again, as Yahweh so often does, he appeals to the natural experiences of man. And we see just how various natural experiences feature in this book. He appeals to the natural experiences of man to try and drive home the lessons. Fire. You can see when a building is on fire, it's an awe-inspiring sight. The temperatures inside are probably beyond comprehension. And the destructiveness, like when we return the following day and just see a blackened carcass of a building that once stood in all its glory, it should be a reminder, it should have been a reminder to them of the results of the destruction that God would bring. And again, shall not the Lamb tremble for this? I remember reading, I think it was in the Christchurch earthquake a couple of years ago, that one individual who was there said that when the ground shakes, it's the most terrifying feeling because it feels like your last ally has deserted you. Because no matter what happens, the ground stands still. When the ground starts shaking, it's like as if the whole of everything is against you. I can't really quite enter that, but I thought it was very interesting to hear that, or to read that interpretation of the events. And again, it shall rise up holy as a flood. Is this referring to the liquefaction that happens when the earth is shaken, when the bonds between the soil particles break down and water rises to the surface? I don't know, but I believe that the earthquake is referred to in chapter 1, verse 1, is almost like a datum point for the chronology, and is also a datum point to remind the people of Israel of what they could expect if they didn't amend their ways. So, as we said, it would not really do us any justice if we were to consider the character of Amos without considering the people of his time, because it really is a parallel to today. Amos was living in the days of the Assyrian superpower, as it was probably growing in strength. And to the discerning eye, they would have been seen as a threat to world peace, I suppose, just like any discerning eye can see Russia as a threat to world peace today, with their aggressive and dominating policies. And it would not have been a secret, especially given in the days of Jonah, we can see that Jonah recognized that Syria would probably be sent as a judgment against Israel. And so Assyria would have been seen to the discerning eye as the source of impending judgment. But the brotherhood in the days of Amos, as is sadly often the case today as well, they were unable to see these signs. They were unable to see the signs on the horizon. Chapter 7, we'll turn there for what we think is an important analogy, the analogy of the plumb line. Chapter 7, verse 7. Thus he showed me, and behold, Yahweh stood upon a wall made by a plumb line, with a plumb line in it. A wall made by a plumb line, with a plumb line in his hand. And Yahweh said unto me, Amos, what seest thou? And I said, a plumb line. Then said Yahweh, behold, I will set a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will not again pass by them any more. A fitting symbol, then, is the plumb line of the spirit, the whole spirit of Amos' prophecy. The searching and undeviating perfect standard of righteousness. A perfect symbol for us today, if you like, of the commandments and the perfect example of Christ. A plumb line does not deviate. A plumb line can't deviate. We may decide to use a spirit level. We may decide to use some advanced electronic equipment. Electronic equipment is only accurate insofar as it's calibrated accurately. A plumb line is only accurate insofar as we can read the bubble. And sometimes, if the bubble tube is not particularly large, it can be difficult to see how accurate it is. But you drop a plumb line, and you are guaranteed 100% accuracy. And likewise, that was what Amos was being told, that God had made this wall. God had provided Israel with a constitution. It was absolutely accurate. It was upright, spiritually upright. There was no deviation in the justice of the laws of Yahweh. This is what Israel had been given. And this was the way in which God, in his love and mercy and providential wisdom, had devised for Israel. He brought them out of Egypt with a great arm, an outstretched arm. He gave them a constitution in circumstances that he saw fitting. He brought them into the land and delivered the land into their hands. He prepared the way for them. He constructed this wall according to his perfect and righteous ways. But that wall was really true. It had been built true. It had been built perfectly in the way that God had seen. But it fell into disrepair and and the lack of maintenance by its constant recourse to the ways and the words of Yahweh resulted in the wall bowing. Similar to the parable of the vineyard, I suppose, which in a like parable fell into disrepair for want of spiritual tending. Turn with me quickly, please, to Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 12. Wherefore, thus saith the Holy One of Israel, because ye despised this word, and trust in oppression and perverseness, and stay thereon, therefore this iniquity shall be to you as a breach ready to fall, swelling out in a high wall, whose breaking cometh suddenly at an instant. The consultancy I work for is working on a scheme at the moment in near Kavartha Park, and there's a wall there, very old, and fell into disrepair. And at the moment, it is literally falling down by the day. And that is what happens. A wall can seem okay for so long, it holds together, but there comes a point where it just cannot stand up. And that is essentially what Amos is being referred to. There was a plumb line, and it may not have been obvious to the natural eye. Things may have looked very good, things may have looked very comfortable in Israel with all their prosperity, but it was on its last legs, spiritually. It would not be long before it would start to fall down. And what can be done with that kind of wall? It's too late for repair and maintenance. It can only be demolished and started again, which is exactly what Yahweh did, and will do it again. So, what was so bad about the nation of Israel then? It was Laodicean, I suppose, is the best way we could describe it. Let's read verses 1 to 5 of chapter 6 of Amos. Amos chapter 6, verse 1. Woe to them that are at ease in Zion, and trust in the mountain of Samaria, which are named chief of the nations, to whom the house of Israel came. Pass ye unto Calneh, and see. And from thence go ye to Hamath the Great. Then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Be they better than these kingdoms, or their border greater than your border? Ye that put far away the evil day, and cause the seat of violence to come near, that lie upon beds of ivory, and stretch themselves upon their couches, and eat the lamb out of the flock, and the calves out of the midst of the stall, that chant to the sound of the viol, and invent themselves instruments of music. And so on. We get this picture then of a people who were enjoying life, for want of a better way of describing it. They had everything they wanted. And the ironic thing, and the thing which really should be a warning to us, is that it wasn't a totally God-excluding way of life. They enjoyed the music, like David. They managed to get life with a religious veneer attached to it. They sang hymns of praise. Although perhaps there was more emphasis on the music than the words. Even the observance of the law fitted loosely into their lifestyle. Rather like many people in the churches and chapels, and as a warning to us, some in the brotherhood. But it did not govern. It did not dictate. It did not control their lives. It did not influence and transform their minds. Verse 6, that drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the chief ointments, but they are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. They were too absorbed with their own ways of life. They couldn't stop, I suppose, just like the parable of the Good Samaritan, they couldn't stop to help others. They really were comfortably off. They were Laodicean. The word had lost its effect. As it says in chapter 9, verse 10, all the sinners of my people shall die by the sword, who say, the evil shall not overtake nor prevent us. Is not this a recurring feature of Israel and mankind at large? Where is the promise of his coming? Those who mocked Noah, those who mocked Lot, they cannot see the destruction coming. Why? Because wealth and prosperity blinds our eyes. And it is sadly often a characteristic of an apathetic household. Chapter 3 and verse 2. You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. Again, what a warning for us. There are great blessings and consequently great responsibilities of being called to be God's people. There is no peace, saith Yahweh, to the wicked. All evildoers shall be cut off. Psalm 37, verse 9. But, says Amos in chapter 5, verse 9, seek Yahweh and ye shall live. It's a simple formula. It's so simple that you can teach it to the child who has barely come into understanding of the things of life. But how flesh tries to modify it. Chapter 5, verse 10, they hate him that rebuketh in the gate, and they abhor him that speaketh uprightly. Again, is this not the sign of an apathetic brotherhood? A brotherhood that doesn't like to be told when it's wrong. A brotherhood that runs away with various feelings of anger at someone who's tried to tell them where they're doing wrong. They hate him that rebuketh in the gate. The righteous is made out to be the sinner, to the point where, just like the world, they call good evil and evil good. And another symptom, we must, I suppose, move on because we haven't even got as far as Amos yet, but chapter 4, verse 1. Hear this, ye kind of Bashan, that are in the mountain of Samaria, which oppress the poor, which crush the needy, which say to their masters, bring and let us drink. And it's suggested that this kind of Bashan are the women of the land. Why? Well, verse 3 says, he shall go out of the breaches, every coward that which is before her, and he shall cast him into the palace, says Yahweh. So we're referring to what would appear to be a female element. Nevertheless, it could be that it's referred to in the female kind of Bashan, cows and such thing, as Yahweh's unfaithful wife. So I take it either way, but I thought it was interesting that perhaps it could be referring to the women. Anyway, Bashan, as we know, is east of Galilee, and apparently it was a very fertile area. It was possessed by the half tribe of Manasseh, and we know that they rather liked the appearance of the land east of the Jordan and requested Moses that they should be able to take their possession there. So it was evidently a fertile area and continued to be so. Og was king of Bashan, if you recall, and the possession of Bashan would have been symbolic of the victory over the nations. But unfortunately, that victory appeared to turn into spiritual defeat. It became synonymous with prosperity and ease. You recall Psalm 22, that famous psalm referring to the crucifixion of Christ, where he refers to those of Bashan. Psalm 22 verse 12 says, be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have compassed me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round. They gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening and a roaring lion. So Bashan then really does seem to be representative here of those who were at ease in Israel. Really not time, unfortunately, but it becomes a symbol of hope as well. If you look at Psalm 68 verse 22 in your own time, Ezekiel 39 verse 18, and Micah 7 verse 14. And unfortunately, we don't have time to turn there. Now, is verse 18 of chapter 5 the most sobering verse in the book? Woe unto you that desire the day of Yahweh. To what end is it for you? The day of Yahweh is darkness and not light. Do any of us go a day without praying for the speedy return of Christ? Do any of us go a day perhaps without commenting, oh, for Christ to return and judge this world? Well, what Israel had to recognize is that despite their praying for the day of Yahweh to come, it was going to be a day of reckoning for them. It was not going to become a day of blessing because they had not put Yahweh first. It is only for a few in every generation that the day of Yahweh will be a day of gladness and rejoicing. For all others, including the many who are called, the many whose love has waxed cold, it will be a day of judgment, a day of weeping and of gnashing of teeth. Chapter 9 verse 7, again another sobering verse. Are ye not as the Ethiopians unto me, O children of Israel, saith Yahweh? Have not I brought up Israel out of the land of Egypt, and the Philistines from Caphtor, and the Syrians from Kir? Israel's great delusion was that because they were chosen of Yahweh, they thought they were something special. Can we be guilty of the same? What really does separate us from the world? We should be like chalk and cheese, to use the modern expression. There should be no similarities between us and the world. And Amos chapter 4 verse 12 says, therefore, thus will I do unto thee, O Israel, and because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. It is rightly said, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And that is something that Amos was trying to appeal to the people. And what Yahweh, through the words of Amos, is trying to appeal unto us. So then, not before time, let's move on to the character of Amos himself. A character who manifested faith and fidelity in a nation characterized by the very opposite. It's worth thinking about this man before we even think about the courage that he must have had. It's worth thinking about the character of Amos in the midst of this Laodicean age. We can sometimes, I think, speaking for myself anyway, detach the man from his surroundings when we look back at the historical lives of these people. We can sort of see Amos as in a little bubble, if you like, speaking to the people around him, and not really recognize what he would have to have dealt with, because for the most part it's not recorded. We are told, and we are given a hint of what these prophets had to endure in the New Testament, like by Paul in Hebrews chapter 11, by the life of Jeremiah. Jeremiah, I don't believe, was unique in what he had to endure. And we really do need to keep that in mind, so that we don't sort of put these people as superhuman or different from us. And I think in terms of the way that Amos conducted himself in this Laodicean age, I think we really can take some powerful exhortations from that. Because Laodiceanism, apathy, call it what you will, isn't selective in who it affects. It can affect everyone. No one is exempt from it. Amos could have succumbed to the spirit of prosperity had he chosen, or rather, had he allowed himself to. We are not the only ones in history who has had to struggle to maintain fidelity in the midst of an affluent household. Amos had to do exactly the same. It would have been as trying to him as it is to us. And again, we possibly tend to think that these people didn't have similar trials to us. In the sense that, yes, they were in the midst of a wicked world, that's nothing new. But the kind of worldliness that these people had to endure and witness in their own people doesn't really sound that appealing to us. Bowing down to idols doesn't particularly grab any of us as something we would really like to do. But are there similarities which may be seen on closer inspection? Let's turn to go back to chapter 4, verse 1. We've already read that. Here then see kind of patient that are in the mountain of Samaria, which oppress the poor, which crush the needy, which say to their masters, bring and let us drink. Verse 4, come to Bethel and transgress. At Gilgal, multiply transgression, and bring your sacrifices every morning and your tithes after 3 years, and offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving with leaven, and proclaim and publish the free offerings. For this liketh you, O ye children of Israel, saith Adonai Yahweh. I think one version says, for this is what you like, O ye children of Israel, saith Adonai Yahweh. Chapter 6 again, verse 4. The lie upon beds of ivory, and stretch themselves upon their couches, and eat the lambs out of the flock, and the calves out of the midst of the stall, that chant to the sound of the viol, and invent themselves instruments of music, like David, that drink wine in bowls, and anoint themselves with the cheap ointments, but they are not grieved to the affliction of Joseph. It really takes a perceptive mind to really put ourselves in these kind of words, because we tend to just read over these words and automatically find condemnation at them. But when you think of the comforts that we have today compared to the comforts of many years ago, those who are familiar with the days of Brother Thomas and his efforts will remember that he had to endure all sorts of hardships on his journeys. And the only reason he was making those journeys was for the truth. And it really kind of makes us ashamed when we think of what we have to put up with. And we really, really do have it very easy. And therefore the lesson for us is that apathy does us no favours. And Amos was not exempt from that. He would have to have taken that same strong attitude to avoid getting caught up in the life of plenty, the life of leisure, the life of eating, and the life of getting possessions. All these things, all these problems, all these symptoms surrounded this humble prophet. But did it soften his resolve? Not a bit of it. Why? What was the secret? I can't remember the exact words of Brother Roberts, but he refers to the battle that we have to face daily. And he says about avoiding the things that would weaken our resolve and engaging in the things that would strengthen that resolve. Again, it's not a secret. It's not a difficult formula. But for some reason, to the weakness and the deceitfulness of the flesh, it seems so difficult to grab hold of and do. But that's what Amos successfully did. And as we said, the power, we made mention at the start of the address to the power of the witnessing. Well, Amos's message to the children of Israel would have been extremely powerful. And it's powerful to us. Why? Is it because he had letters after his name? Is it because he was something great? Was he a king in Israel? Did he achieve great military victories? No. It's because he was a humble character. It's because he was a humble character and had no complications in his life and purely did the service of Yahweh. A prophet appearing to Israel, possibly rich, with nice house, plenty of possessions, no worries, would not have had the same effect. And it does not have the same effect to us today. We often see that the poorest are the people whose faith is greatest. Chapter 7, verse 14, where we do really get an inkling into the life and character of Amos. Then answered Amos and said to Amaziah, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. So he wasn't well educated. He was a worker. He wasn't some great financier. He wasn't some great politician. He wasn't in the court of the kings. He was a gatherer of sycamore fruit. And Thompson, in his book, refers to the sycamore fruit as being poor fare. He says, still, they are at best very insipid, sycamore fruit, and none but the poorer classes eat them. So Amos identified himself with the poor of Israel, not the wealthy. And does this not perhaps ring true, remind us of some other characters in the scriptures, namely, not least of all, John and his cousin, the Lord Jesus Christ. Luke chapter 3 verse 1. I will never forget my mother, when we would do these readings, and she would refer to these verses when I was a young lad, and it's stuck with me ever since, just how powerful these verses are. It says, "Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, the greatest man on the earth, Pontius Pilate, the greatest man in Israel, being governor of Judea, and Herod, being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea, and of the reign of Trachonitis, and Lysanias, the tetrarch of Abilene." All these great people, and now we move on to some spiritual greats, so-called, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priests. The word of God came unto John, and nobody essentially, nothing is said of John. The word of God came unto John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness. And the humble origins of John were equally humble for Christ, who was, as we know, a carpenter's son. And even the great men of the scriptures, when we look at David, Brother Ewan brought out yesterday, David wasn't trained in the courts of kings. He was trained on the hills of Israel, tending sheep. What humbler occupation can we think of? And this is the character of Yahweh's witnesses. Humility is the recipe for God's success. Moses, after his 40 years in the courts of Pharaoh, not for 1 minute doubting his faithfulness, thought that he was ready to lead Israel out of the land of Egypt. But no. 40 years of adversity in the wilderness is what Yahweh saw fit for him, to make him prepared to lead his people. Brother Robert in Nazareth Revisited says, "Men of great polish and high natural gift would have been liable to fall into this mistake without design." The mistake he's referring to is the attitude of thinking that educated men are better, and would have been better for the purposes God had. "So men of great polish and high natural gift would have been liable to fall into this mistake without design. They would have figured largely in the eyes of the public and would have been in danger of becoming important in their own eyes, especially with miraculous power at their command. God would not have been so visible as the instruments." So what Brother Robert is saying again is that a humble background, he's referring to the fishermen that Christ chose as his assistants in the work of preaching the gospel, that humility is the key to the success of one of God's servants. And humility is forsaking self, forgetting about ourselves, our own interests, our own achievements, and essentially making God the centre of glory. And this is the same with Amos. It's interesting, we saw that earthquakes are a feature of the book. Fire is a feature of the book. I believe they both go together. There's another recurring feature of this book, and that is agriculture or farming. We turn to chapter 1, because again, just like Yahweh prepared David for the work ahead of him in tending sheep, it would have prepared him for the way of looking after God's sheep, the people of Israel. Amos was just the same. His experiences were beneficial to the use that God would make of him later. Chapter 1, verse 2. "And he said, Yahweh will roar from Zion, and utter his voice from Jerusalem. And the habitations of the shepherds shall mourn, and the top of Carmel shall wither. Thus saith Yahweh, for 3 transgressions of Damascus, and for 4 I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron." I'm not going to deal with what we're talking about here. I'm just looking at the agricultural element of this book. But nevertheless, we can see again If we could live in that day, where we would be familiar with the threshing process, we would understand that what is being referred to is exceptional violence. When we see threshing, we use sharp iron tools, smashing the wheat to separate the husk from the kernel of the wheat, which is the bit you want. And it would have been a long, violent process. And we can see that the way that Yahweh was appealing to his people to see these things. Chapter 2, verse 13. Behold, I am pressed under you as a cart is pressed that is full of sheaves. Chapter 5, verse 11. For as much therefore as your treading is upon the poor, and you take from him burdens of wheat, you have built houses of whose form, but he shall not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but he shall not drink wine of them. So we can see then that the humble life that was prepared by Amos was suitable for the message that he was to deliver. Had he been in king's courts, the message would not have been as powerful to him, and therefore would not have been as powerful to the people who heard him. Now we go back to chapter 7, verse 14, because there's an interesting fact here that should tell us that these men of courage, these giants of faith, were not Hercules. They weren't people who feared nothing. Because again, we tend to detach them from the emotions and the feelings of the flesh. Verse 12 is the context. Amaziah said unto Amos, O thou seer, go flee thee away into the land of Judah, and there eat bread and prophesy there. But prophesy not again any more at Bethel, for it is the king's chapel, and it is the king's court. So, the unfriendly overtures then of the king of Israel made Amos respond in the following. Then answered Amos and said to Amaziah, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. And Yahweh took me as I followed the flock. And Yahweh said unto me, go prophesy unto my people Israel. It caused Amos to remind those around him that he had very humble origins. He had to remind them that he had no axes to grind. He had nothing to gain from this. And the unfriendly overtures of those in Israel would have been a cause of concern to Amos. And just like us, just like Jeremiah, would have feared the consequences. And we really have to remind ourselves that prophesying of destruction goes against the grain. And we do need to keep that in mind, so that we recognise that we don't look at others like Amos, like Jeremiah and Ezekiel and so on, and think that was okay for them, they weren't afraid. Nothing is harder to the flesh than to tell those around you that destruction is coming. And we need to remember that, so that we do not excuse ourselves for not being as courageous as they were. We can tend to look back and see Dr. Thomas and Robert Roberts as almost invincible, as untouched by the things that we suffer with. But Brother Thomas referred on at least one occasion to the violence that speaking in public did to his disposition or his constitution. And there's an extract I have here reminding us of how difficult things were for him, so that we don't distance ourselves from those who have gone before. It was in Virginia. There was at the meeting house in a town called Rappahannock, which had been closed by Campbell's followers, which meant that the only way Brother Thomas could address the public was by doing it outside. He said the ground was cleared up, a stand erected and seats provided. The weather was fine, but the foliage not being quite dense enough, the sun would sometimes shine in upon us inconveniently. The fable of the dog in the manger well illustrates the Rappahannock and the grove in this point of view. A commodious meeting house was in sight, but the reformers would neither use it themselves nor permit their neighbours its protection from the stroke of a July sun. Under all the circumstances of the case, however, we had more ground of congratulation than complaint. We addressed the people 3 hours on each day on the things of the kingdom, and showing also how it was to be set up by the God of heaven. Mr. Magruder spoke on Sunday afternoon on some things not touched upon by us. He found, even as we, that speaking in the open air was no refreshing pastime, but a labour of some severity, which we unrepiningly accept as a modicum of the evil inflicted upon us. by the Baptists for the good we propose to do them. End of the quote. I only quoted that somewhat out of context to remind us that we can so often excuse ourselves for not doing various things, and yet the likes of Amos could find no excuse. Jeremiah refers to the fact that he wanted to stop talking about the things of Yahweh, but he couldn't because it was in his bones as a living fire. What makes such characters? It's simply faith and dedication. And let's turn to we don't have time at all. Amos, let's start to bring our remarks to a close. We turn to Amos chapter 3 and verse 3 as a powerful closing remark on the man Amos, I suppose. Can two walk together except they be agreed? How often do we refer to this verse? Rightly do we refer to this verse, to be fair. We naturally, left to ourselves, have no agreement. We have no affinity with Yahweh. His is the mind of the Spirit. Ours is the mind of the flesh. But with constant study and meditation on His Word, and constant recourse to the ways of Yahweh in prayer, we come to assimilate to the intelligent mind of the Spirit and lose our natural base evil tendencies. As Paul says, we are renewed in the spirit of our minds. Amos was one such character that had risen to the standard and walked with Yahweh, just like Enoch walked with Yahweh. The plumb line in reference to Amos's life was Amos's wall, I suppose, in relation to the plumb line, was true. Unlike the people he lived around. Again, why do we turn this verse up? Because how could Amos stand there and tell the people of their ways, condemn them for their doings, unless he himself walked with Yahweh? Brother Grocott said, "We cannot help think of Brother Thomas when we think of Amos, personally gentle and sympathetic, but rigidly resolute and unsparing in condemnation of ungodliness and ungodly systems." Because we see in Amos some compassion. We see him pleading with Yahweh to turn away the judgment. But at the same time, Amos recognized that judgment is due to those who work iniquity. And this then is the balance for all brothers and sisters, is it not? We must hate evil, and as Brother Grocott says, we must hate it most of all in ourselves. So we must hate evil, and we must long for the days when the earth will be filled with Yahweh's glory. But we must be merciful. And Brother Grocott even says that we must be merciful to those in the world. It's so easy perhaps for us to think, well, your time is coming. True, the world's time is coming, but perhaps we should manifest more mercy and be like Amos. And so in conclusion then, we'll just recap by saying that God's people, they were His chosen people. They had been called out of Egypt. They were a special people. There was no one like them, and there is no one like them today. But they found themselves condemned with the wicked nations around them. One would think that being God's people, we would have had the judgments against Moab, against Syria, against Philistia, Ammon, Edom, and then a soft, loving, congratulatory message on Israel. But no. We find that the same words used for the nations around were used against Israel. For three transgressions of Damascus and for four. For three transgressions of Samaria and for four. For three transgressions of Jerusalem and for four. It was the same for the rejected. It will be the same for the rejected in the time to come. They will Let's hope we can say they will. Or meet their end in the lake of fire burning with brimstone. Israel met the same destruction that met Syria, Moab and Edom. And the rejected at the return of Christ will meet their same destruction with the nations of Sodom and spiritual Egypt. Alternatively, we can all seek Yahweh as Amos says and live. Even Amos, in closing, offers a picture of hope. There could be no hope to a nation so bent on destruction, so bent on their evil ways. But if you turn to chapter 9, and we read the last 5 verses, verse 11. In that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof. And I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the heathen, which are called by my name, saith Yahweh that doeth this. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that the ploughman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed. And the mountains shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. And I will bring again the captivity of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. And they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof, and they shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them. And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of their land, which I have given them, saith Yahweh, thy Elohim. That nation, though, was doomed. But there is a glorious picture, not nationally. And the picture of glory is not to the brotherhood at large. It is to those few who heed the warnings of the prophets, who heed the words of Amos. For all these words apply as much to us as they did to Israel. Psalm 64 verse 10 says, "The righteous shall be glad in Yahweh and shall trust in him, and all the upright in heart shall glory."